Friends of a Dilemma, the podcast of the Texas National Security Review, TNSR. I'm Doyle Hodges, executive editor of TNSR. In this week's episode of Horns, we get an update on the Russia-Ukraine war and what it's done and what it means for international security from Daniel Feda, president of Feda Advisory LLC and former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for European and NATO policy. Feda outlines the history dating back to the Bush 41 administration that may have led Russia to believe that it could invade Ukraine and that the invasion would be successful. He then evaluates the impact of these policies on the ongoing conflict as well as its implications for security around the world. Let's listen in.
I thought it would be helpful to talk about where we are with this, with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. How did we get here? You know, what's happened? Where might it go? And then what are the bigger consequences or issues as students of political science, as students of international relations that we need to be looking for? Because I think there could be some tectonic disruptions as a result of this war. So with that, I want to start really by just I know it's a topic that's in the news, but when you just step back and think about what's happening, what is it that we're witnessing? You know, we're witnessing a fight for a nation. Some would say we're witnessing a fight for Europe, a fight for the international order, for sovereignty and democracy. Some say, as you look at this, it's the purest black and white issue of heroism versus dictatorship, of hubris. And failed military planning of a nation sort of coming together because they know it's about their survival. We're seeing nations around the world, particularly at the UN General Assembly this week, that are condemning Russian actions and those that are looking the other way. You listen to President Macron of France or the UN Secretary General and President Biden. And like, look, you need to pick sides. Neutrality is not an option here. This is something between good versus evil, to use Reagan-era type comments. We're seeing a leader in Zelensky who has nationwide, if not worldwide, support. And we're seeing a nation, a leader in terms of President Putin who has artificial support and now is taking, as some might argue, desperate measures in order to shore up something that has been a complete failure from just about anybody's perspective. The use of commercial technology, including open source satellite imagery in order to conduct military operations, has been nothing short of fantastic on the Ukrainian side. But there will be those on the other side, whether it's Russia, whether it's China, whether it's others, that will also seek that as a new battlefront, a new area in which to deny people in the future. And so you see an outpouring of support from Poland and Romania in terms of all these Ukrainian refugees that just prior 18 months ago, 12, 14 months ago, there were real issues with the Ukrainian government about Ukrainian national diasporas in both of these countries. And the war would change all that. Unfortunately, you're also seeing fissures in American politics about what and how long to continue to support Ukraine, whether to support Ukrainian reconstruction, what America's role in Europe should be, and what Europe's role in providing security for its own should be. And so there is a lot that's going on as we look at this. And again, we're going to get to a little bit more of this as we get to the end. But I'd like to spend a few minutes thinking about how did we get here? And as Will said, he and I had the opportunity to work in the Bush administration together and in the job that I held for 3 years, which is one of the best jobs you can have in Washington, being a deputy assistant secretary, particularly with a boss or bosses that empower you and trust your view. I got to have a front row seat, and I was in, I can use many sports analogies, in the bullpen, on the field, whatever it is you want, to help shape some of these policies. Again, as I joked when I started, not all of them were successful. And I think a lot of what we're seeing today, unfortunately, was the result of some of those policies that we put into place back then. So how did we get to where we are? Three main reasons, I think, as to why Russia has invaded Ukraine and why we're in this issue. First is the West's desire to have Ukraine and Georgia integrate into Western institutions. So to integrate into NATO and EU. For us to integrate and for Putin, it was a red line. He said this was not going to go. So there was both a pull and a push and a pull. And that's sort of issue number one. And I'll come back to that in a second. The second one is that Putin thought he could do this operation and prevail in Ukraine. And I'll explain why he thought that. And then third is based on a series of actions going back to the beginning of the Bush administration, Bush 43, so George W. Bush, through this administration, the Biden administration, the signals we gave were to Putin were ones that we won't intervene. And so let's walk through those real quick. So the West's desire to have Ukraine and Georgia integrate was a big part of the Bush 43 agenda. But frankly, it goes back to the Clinton administration, too. When all those nations became free after the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was a lot of effort to look at how can we extend democracy, free market capitalism to Central and Eastern Europe, which included the areas of the Caucasus, Georgia and Ukraine. 1994, NATO creates this program called Partnership for Peace to start that process of developing contact between the nations and NATO, civmil control, to teach institutional capacity building, to do some joint training and education. By the end of the decade, the end of the 90s, we're already seeing the first few countries of Central and Eastern Europe now join the alliance, Poland, Hungary, and Czech Republic. By 2004, seven additional members of Central and Eastern Europe, so the three Baltics, Slovakia, Romania, Bulgaria, Slovenia, they are now members of NATO. So 10 countries that 12 years prior or 13 years prior were part of the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet Union are now in NATO and on their way towards European Union. Georgia and Ukraine were two that President Bush felt very strongly about, as did many in Congress and throughout and on both sides. Both countries had had revolutions, the Rose and Orange revolutions in their countries that got rid of the former Soviet era leaders and now brought in arguably free market Democrats. This was a threat to Putin. For Putin, who had seen much of Central and Eastern Europe now make its path towards the West, he wasn't quite looking for a Soviet reunion, but he was looking for to maintain as much stability in his sphere, his influence as he could, because this was threatening his home rule and his grasp on what was happening throughout Russia. And so just to go a little faster, because I don't want to get too bogged down on this, President Bush was committed to having these two nations, Georgia and Ukraine, get as close to NATO during his tenure as possible. President Bush also had this affinity, maybe too strong of a word, but he felt he had a relationship with President Putin. Early in the Bush presidency, he said, "I've looked into his eyes and I've seen his soul, and he's someone that we can work with." And for the majority of me and Will's time in government, yours too, I guess, Paul, during the 2000s, there was many efforts made to try to figure out how we can work with the Russians. But then in February 2007, I was with Secretary Gates on his first trip to Europe. There was a conference that takes place in Munich called the Munich Security Conference. And Putin laid out, first time, only time he's ever speaking to that audience, laid out for everybody what was wrong with America and why Europe, you guys were sycophants that were going along with this hyperbolic superpower of America. And you needed to wake up. Well, they did wake up. Europe did wake up. There was a lot of head nodding, or as a military friend told me this morning, there was a lot of going north and south with their heads. Until Putin called into question one of the European security organizations called the OSCE. And at that moment, the Europeans snapped out of it. And they realized that Putin actually had designs on Europe. And so what would happen would be a series of conversations that would take place over the next year and a half, trying to figure out ways to understand where Putin was, trying to understand where there are areas of cooperation. But President Bush did not yield on the idea of Ukraine and Georgia potentially getting closer to NATO. And at dinner last night with Will and some others, talked about a trip that Secretary Gates, myself, and one of my bosses made to Moscow in March of 2007, and Putin told Secretary Gates, it's in Secretary Gates' book, that, look, you don't understand what it was like. You in the West don't understand what it was like and what has happened in Russia. Our people, it wasn't just a collapse of the Soviet Union, it was a collapse of the Russian Empire. The West came in and took advantage of Russia and Russian people, Russian businesses, and my job is to restore Russian influence in the world. He never said positive or negative. And so, again, that would lead to a variety of activities that we would spend with Russia trying to figure out where we could get cooperation. It would ultimately culminate in April of 2008 at a NATO summit in Bucharest. Again, I had the opportunity to join the President and Secretary Gates there. And in the lead up to that, and again, I know this is a little bit of a history lesson, but it really does make it does explain where we are today. There was this tool that NATO created called the Membership Action Plan, which was basically what it was. It was a plan for how a particular country would get closer to NATO and ultimately would become a NATO member. But there was never a timeline on this. And all those Central and Eastern European allies I just talked about earlier all had one of these membership action plans. President Bush was convinced we needed to do this for Georgia and Ukraine. There are others in the department, in the government, and amongst our allies that said, no, we can't do this. Because if you extend this membership action plan to Georgia and Ukraine, you're basically saying they can become members. And either they're not fully democratic enough, they're not geographically contiguous enough to NATO, that it'll be too hard to defend. My boss, Secretary Gates, was one of those. I was the senior most person in the department that had a different view. My view was we needed to extend membership action plan to these two countries because we needed them to continue on their westward trajectory. We had enough indications from Putin that he had, you know, this was going to be difficult for him and he was going to make life difficult for them, Georgia and Ukraine. But we needed to have those, that process, that sort of forward-looking thing to keep the reforms going. And that's where President Bush and Condoleezza Rice were as well. So the summit happens. Summit instantly breaks down because a couple members said, we oppose extending membership action plan to Georgia. So they have to go into something that's called an extraordinary session where it's just the president and plus one and they all talk and they come up with an agreement. And the agreement is not that they would extend membership action plan, but they actually would include language that says Ukraine and Georgia will one day become members. So you sort of skip this whole path and plan to get there and just will one day become members. So Secretary Gates and I are in a separate room when this is happening, and he looks at me, he goes, well, you must be happy. And I said, I'm not. He goes, why not? And I said, because Putin controls the timetable now. And he goes, Feta, you'll never be happy. You know, 3 weeks after that, I was telling Will this, I was sent to Georgia to go tell the Georgian government, be careful of what's happening. We have intelligence indications that the Russians are building up forces for this exercise that they're going to do in the North Caucasus, and they may not leave. And the exercise was two breakaway regions of a former Soviet republic, have Russian passport holders, citizens there, and the host nation is threatening to revoke or do things. And so a lot of, you could say it was a war game, you could say it was fabrication, but you could also say it's what we're seeing today in Ukraine as well, particularly as Putin is thinking of holding these referendums over the next couple days. Well, anyways, the war in Georgia would happen. And one of the lessons learned was, Putin says stuff that he means. We may not believe it in the West, but he means what he says. And he was telegraphing, if you all do something in Georgia and Ukraine, this is a red line for me. And so that's one of those lessons learned from back then. So again, point number one was we had a desire. It was a red line. So cause number one as to why I think where we are today. Cause number two was I think Putin thought he could really pull this off. I think, you know, there's a variety of, and we'll get into this in a second, variety of reasons why he thought so. But he didn't think the Ukrainian forces were up to snuff. He thought his forces were. And again, folks in this room have had careers and lifetimes working intelligence issues. I've worked the policy side of things. But, you know, depending on which organization you work in, sometimes you feed the boss the information he or she wants to hear, and not necessarily the information they need to hear. And I think part of what we've seen in this war, and it'll come out at some point, is that the right information wasn't provided. And you can also argue maybe there was some hubris here. But again, point number two is he thought he could do it. So that leads to point number three of why do I think we got here? And that is, it's what has happened, what the West has done in terms of trying to find that way of peaceful coexistence with Putin, and then really not wanting to accept who he really is. And so I talked to you about President Bush, and I gave you the lead up to the Georgia War. Well, after the Russia-Georgia War, there really weren't any consequences for President Putin in the immediate aftermath. And by the time the Obama administration would come in early 2009, the war was August of 2008. By the beginning of 2009, the new administration, Secretary Clinton and others, were calling for a reset with Russia. So no real penalties, and there was a reset. And now what would happen is they would try to find, like we did in the Bush administration, constructive ways to work together. But it was almost forgotten what happened in Georgia. And then in 2014, there is a move. Again, remember I told you part of the West's goal was to bring Ukraine closer. There was a move. The EU had extended two levels down of membership status to Ukraine, and there was going to be a referendum in the across the Ukrainian public whether to accept it and to move closer to the EU. And the Kremlin-aligned leader, Yanukovych, at the time, blocked the referendum from happening. There were another round of big protests. Yanukovych would flee to Moscow, and Putin would send in forces to protect Russian citizens in Ukraine. And that's when you moved a lot of forces into the Donbas and the Luhansk and everything that we're seeing is being fought over now. The West did some condemnations, did some sanctions, but it went away. And by 2017, NATO Secretary General says Russia does not pose a threat to the alliance, even though Russia still had its forces in the Ukraine. Now, technically, Ukraine is not a member of the alliance, but the view was Russia didn't pose a threat. And then you have a series of things, starting with COVID, where nations now start looking insular. You have Trump's comments about Europe, Trump's embrace of Putin. You have Biden come in. You have a Biden-Trump fight. You have January 6th. You have the Afghan withdrawal. And you have the stepping down of Chancellor Merkel in Germany. So you have this pattern of everything from I think I can do it, to the international community as such. They never really have put much penalty on me. I don't think they have the spine and stomach. Those that could potentially have strong voices look pretty weak. I think I'm going to go for it. And that's what we wind up seeing. We wind up seeing Russia take or Putin taking advantage of this, thinking he can do it. And 7 months later, as Will said, they're still at it. And so what's happened over this period is the U.S. has become, has sort of reemerged as the undisputed leader of the alliance. God bless the Poles, God bless the U.K. and others, but no one could have mobilized the response to support Ukraine other than the United States. The United States started 6 months early. I've been out to NATO twice over the past 2 months having conversations about the war, about the recent NATO summit and other things and how it all came about. And the reality was the United States, starting in October of last year, started briefing the Ukrainians, started briefing the allies about what they were seeing, sort of like 2008 all over again. Those indications that we're seeing this exercise build up now with Belarus, right above, right north of the Ukrainian border, of something that one has a really similar simulation, like it was in Ukraine, about Ukrainian, Russian citizens that might be in danger. And we're seeing a larger force than there was in Ukraine. And so the U.S. would make this information and intelligence available to the allies, and the allies wouldn't buy it. Absolutely not. And this is just coming off the heels of the Afghanistan withdrawal. It's coming years after not the most accurate Iraq intelligence and other things. So U.S. intelligence had a credibility problem with the allies. But they also didn't believe Putin would do it, even though they already saw 2008 and they already saw 2014. They just didn't believe that Russia would do it. So the U.S. would stay at it. And eventually the Brits and the Poles would come on board to also, they would have corroborating intelligence. And it would take the president of the United States talking about this publicly, other allies talking about publicly, getting the Ukrainians to actually come on board and actually believe it. Because the Georgians in 2008 didn't believe it could happen. So it took a while for the Ukrainians to come around to believe it. But once they believed it, the United States and a couple allies really stepped up in terms of additional training, helping on a variety of disciplines that we can't talk about in this room to make sure that they were ready. But even until the eve of the war, the NATO allies still didn't believe it was going to happen. And for those that were waffling, the view was, well, Ukraine can never last. They'll never be able to survive. And so let's be very careful about just how much we throw their way. And so, again, 7 months later, we see the Ukrainians on a counteroffensive, inflicting tremendous damage to the Russian forces, not without their own damage to the Ukrainian forces. And you find there's an alliance now that's nearly unified in terms of supporting this. And as someone said to me last week when I was out at NATO, they said, Ukraine isn't just fighting for Ukraine. It's fighting for Europe and it's fighting for the world. And so when we think about some of the bigger consequences here, we'll get to that. But the U.S. led that effort, and there's been a lot of folks. I happen to be a Republican, and there's a lot of friends in my circle that we served in Bush 43 and or some had served in Trump that really feel that Biden failed, that this has been a failure. Ukraine would not be at war if it wasn't for Biden. And I said to them, I said, look, it's the other five-letter word. It's Putin. It's not Biden. This is 100% because of Putin. In fact, Ukraine wouldn't be standing as a nation if it wasn't for what President Biden and his team were able to rally. That doesn't mean they didn't make mistakes. And I think another thing in the list of why Putin did what he did was President Biden and the NATO leaders were pretty adamant that they will defend every square inch of NATO territory. But if you're Putin, you're hearing, okay, so you're going to protect up to the line, but Ukraine's on this line, so that's mine. You're not going to cross this line. And so there are some that would say that one of, if there was a failure, it's that we didn't, or that President Biden broke from previous presidential playbooks and didn't say, and if you go after Ukraine, all options are on the table. The deterrent aspect was no longer there. It was talking about sanctions, but no potential military. And to this day, NATO, this administration, and others really are very careful about making it look like the United States and or NATO is now involved in the direct conflict. There are also those that say that, well, if only we gave Ukraine more arms in the first few days, this war would be over. But again, as I mentioned to you all, no one believed Ukraine could survive. And so no one was going to be willing to be able to push HIMARS and all these heavy systems in there. I think we've overcome the arguments that the Ukrainians need more time to be trained. You give them the system and they go with it. And so as I joke, anyone who's heard me talk about this in recent weeks, you know, this issue of incrementalism in terms of material support for the Ukrainians, it's similar to an airport delay. If you knew you were going to be delayed for 12 hours, you would have done something different. If we knew the Ukrainians were going to prevail, we would have given them more arms and other things early. But we didn't know. And we didn't know how long this was going to go. We actually didn't know how horribly bad the Russians would execute this mission and how brilliant and innovative the Ukrainians were in order to defeat the Russian forces and to push back on them. So there's been a lot that's happened. We've all watched the fighting, you know, from this Russian advance to now a Ukrainian counteroffensive to a stalemate. And when I was out in NATO at the end of July, there was stalemate period, and there was a lot of talk about, look, Zelensky's just gotta settle because it's not gonna go his way. To I'm out at NATO last week, and it's like, we need to give Zelensky everything he has so he can finish this, right? Ukrainian public opinion, IRI, a group that Will and I work with, they polled the Ukrainians back in June and July. 98%, actually, I got the data right here. 98% of the Ukrainian people believe they will win the war. This is back in June and July. It's got to be higher now if they were to poll. President Zelensky has a 91% approval rating. 64% of the Ukrainian people said the war shouldn't end until they get back all the territory that was lost in 2014. So there's no, if you're Zelensky, a guy that wasn't popular prior to the war, there is no reason to back down. There is no reason to back down. And every speech that man makes, it's all about, you know, we're fighting for everyone and we need more from you. There is no question about the heart and the dedication of the Ukrainian forces. And so what we see within the past 24, 36 hours is a desperation move by President Putin. He's now calling up or activating a small chunk of the 300 reservists, but he's only bringing those up that have already done some kind of conscription training. The rich kids that are part of this reserve are not being called up. He has plenty of articles on this. Putin can't afford to lose the oligarchs. He can't afford to have this get much more worse than it already is for your average Russian family. We saw the comments that he also made about potentially doing whatever it takes to defend the territory of Ukraine. With that, he's referring to the use of nuclear weapons, but he's also talking about the ability of the Ukrainian forces to now strike into Russian territory, which has happened over the past 7 to 10 days. They've struck ammo depots, they've struck bridges on the Russian side in order to prevent resupply from the Russian side into Ukraine, not just in the areas that the Russians have been holding since 14. And so there is a lot going on. And so how might it end? Back in the spring, I started saying there were four likely scenarios, and I still believe there's four likely scenarios. The first one, in no particular order other than the last one, is that somehow the Ukrainians are able to prevail. And I think how do you define prevail? Do they get all the territory back that they've lost? Are they able to make the fight for Crimea? Or are they able to get enough where Putin has to say, okay, got it. Or the international community, it really feels strong enough where they can pressure Putin to say enough. Scenario two is that Russia wins. And at this point in the game, I only see Russia being able to win by either decapitating Zelensky, which I think has been high on their list for a long time, or by doing the unthinkable, and that is using a tactical nuke and keeps the threat out there that a second or a third or a fourth could be used. And at that point, Zelensky has no choice but to sue for a negotiated settlement. I won't use the word surrender, but sue for a negotiated settlement. The third, which I believe is probably the most likely writ large, and I'd like to see the Ukrainian forces in the best battlefield position for this, is it all ends through a negotiated settlement. And there has to be some kind of understanding of, you know, here's what Ukrainian security looks like. Here are provisions by which Eastern Ukraine will be governed. I haven't quite thought through all of what that looks like, but that's where both countries have to sort of come together, maybe with an international moderator. The Turks, the French, and others are all trying to play that role. But it really just becomes a negotiated settlement, either by choice or by force. And the fourth, which is the one, well, using a nuke in scenario two is not good, but the fourth is actually it goes the other way, that it gets bigger and drags on. And so we've heard the reports, again, I don't have access and I wouldn't use it in this room anyways, about Russia courting Pyongyang for military weapons, Iran providing more weapons. And we know that Putin and Chinese President Xi met last week. And while there is this public talk of Putin admitting that Xi wasn't happy with him, we truly don't understand that relationship. And so does China, North Korea, Iran now get involved in the war through supplying either mercenaries and or weapons that would allow Putin to get an edge again back on Ukraine? Putin could also decide that if these referendums in eastern Ukraine are successful and those four breakaway regions decide to vote to join Moscow, that he has no choice but to double down and reinforce those. And he could try to pick a fight with NATO. NATO won't fall for the bait. But you could see an errant missile strike. You could see an activation of forces up in Kaliningrad. And for those that understand European geography, you have Poland here, you have Lithuania here, and you have Kaliningrad here. 100,000 forces, nuclear missiles, tremendous amount of it's a massive arms depot. And there's a lot of soldiers there that if Putin really wanted to get cheeky, he could say, I'm going to move those forces to reinforce eastern Ukraine, and you guys try to stop me. So there's a couple ways in which this could get real big and real ugly. My view is it's going to come down to a negotiated settlement one way or the other. But how would we get there? And what are those factors that are going to influence this? And what I would say is it's really three. It's U.S. public support. It's Western European government actions. And then it's Russian public and oligarch support. And so with regard to the first, as I mentioned to you in my opening comments, I really am concerned about where the Washington Republicans are in terms of its endurance to be able to support Ukraine. And I think it's being witnessed, it's being watched in Europe, and it doesn't make sense to them. You know, why would the U.S. spend all this on the military side to not be there for the reconstruction side? Doesn't the U.S. and the American people understand what's at stake? And there's this funky game for anyone who's watching congressional politics and the midterm elections where I'd like to think people don't really think this, but they're playing this game that, look, we've done our job and now it's somebody else's. And so when it comes to the negotiated settlement, how much support the U.S. has for what happens after the ink is dry is going to be very, very important. With regard to the Europe angle, so during the stalemate period of just, you know, a few weeks ago, there was a lot of talk by the Western Europeans that we don't see the Biden administration stepping up to the plate to fund the billions in reconstruction. So therefore, hundreds of billions of reconstruction for Ukraine. So therefore, that's going to fall upon us in Eastern Europe. I'm sorry, in Western Europe. And so that gives us leverage over Zelensky. We can tell him to stop the fighting, but again, particularly during the stalemate period, because it's going to get cold for us here in Western Europe, and we don't have the commitment. And so let's just figure out what we need to do to get Zelensky to stop the fight. I just rattled off all the public opinion data. There's no way Zelensky's going to stop the fight. But Zelensky knows he runs a $10 billion a month shortage of being able to keep government services and government salaries going. He needs that money from the West. The United States is contributing $2 billion a month towards that, but the other $8 billion has to come from somewhere else in order to keep government services going. He's going to be tremendously dependent upon Western Europe in order to keep his country going. And so the battlefield moves he's making will put him in a stronger place and hopefully can squash some of that Western European moves or pressure. Now, Eastern Europe, Central and Eastern Europe, while they're not financially strong enough to be able to rebuild Ukraine on their own, they, as members of the European Union, are very vocal in pushing back against Western Europe, that we can't show division to Russia. We can't show division. We can't show that we don't have staying power. And so for those that have watched the news, Germany decided to nationalize one of its major energy companies today in order to ensure that there's the ability to continue to provide gas throughout the winter months. And so then the third is the Russian public and the oligarch actions. So I would have thought by now that the oligarchs would have put their arm around Putin and said, you know, Vlad, this has been fun. It's been a good run with you guys, but it's starting to hurt our wallets now. And so you need to end this. That doesn't mean it hasn't happened. Maybe those that have are the ones that have fallen out of the windows in all these different places. But I think he's really running short on oligarchic support. I think the sanctions are starting to take a bite. And for the first time in years, probably in his entire reign, Putin is really seeing legislators and the public start to come out and say no more. This isn't the war we want. You lied to us. This isn't what we want. And so I think there's going to be a lot of pressure. Well, for any of you, and there's plenty of folks in this room that have studied authoritarian regimes and what happens when desperation sets in, the grip gets tighter. The grip gets tighter and it becomes more dangerous for everybody involved, for the citizens, for the generals, for the intelligence officers, and also for those that are on the other end of the barrel. And so it's going to get real interesting. And so where the U.S. and Europe are able to stay united and continue to provide more force and make sure Zelensky is able to maintain momentum is going to be key here. So when it's over, what do we need to be looking for? I think there's a real question of what does deterrence look like going forward? It's a big strategic question. So, you know, yes, Putin has not attacked NATO. So that deterrent worked there. But here is NATO with three nuclear power or nuclear armed members, the United States, France, and the UK. And we weren't able to stop an attack. Having nuclear weapons wasn't able to stop an attack on a sovereign country. Now, there are those who will say, but Ukraine, NATO and its strategic deterrent worked because it hasn't been attacked. But when you go back to 2008 and you use that language, we'll one day become members. Are you not obligated in some way to be able to defend, protect? Don't you feel some responsibility for those two countries you said that we will one day become members? Don't know, which is part of the second thing we need to look at is when we make commitments, do we need to be able to back them up? John Bolton would say, we left Ukraine and Georgia in an area of strategic ambiguity with that statement back in 2008, and Russia took advantage of it. And we never, the Western we never really followed up on it because Putin was able to disrupt Georgia, and so Georgia doesn't have territorial control over all of its country, and Ukraine doesn't either. So we left both these countries in the lurch. And so what does making commitments and partnership mean? And if you're Taiwan, if you're a country in East Asia, and you know China is out there, what kind of commitments are you going to want that you're going to want to make, and how much do you believe that the United States and Western Europe will be there for you? I think there's a lot of lessons learned coming out of this war as to how to conduct warfare, how you use drones, how you use long-range precision fire, secure communications, satellite imagery, and then all the counters that go with it, counter drones, counter batteries, all that stuff. And are tanks needed for the fight of the future? Is it resilient, attritable type systems that are relatively low cost that can go in like those Ukrainian drones did with a hand grenade that as it drops, it pulls the pin that costs, you know, you can get this, well, the stores don't exist anymore, but Radio Shack. But you can theoretically go to Radio Shack, buy one of these cheap drones and do stuff like that. So there's a lot of war that's how the conduct of war looks that will have to be out there. The future of democracy versus authoritarianism. Now, I want to believe that Ukraine is going to prevail, but it's not a guarantee. And so therefore, the fight for democracy will still go on. And if somehow Putin is able to prevail, again, through a wicked means of a nuclear weapon, or Zelensky is forced to negotiate a settlement, what message does that send to China? What message does it send to Russia? Have we once again sort of caved on things with Russia because either it's easy or we want that better relationship with them? Look, the list of this big strategics go on. Certainly, what is China learning from this? What is Taiwan learning from this? If you're China, how do I insulate my economy? Because I know the first thing that's going to happen is sanctions are going to come. And then they'll try to unplug my internet and other things. And so what do my first few hours look like? How much do I telegraph what I'm going to do in Taiwan? Because the Russians certainly had been telegraphing, or commercial satellite and other imagery was there. So would the Chinese do something by surprise? And so there's a lot of lessons to be learned there. I think the last one for me will be, after this war ends, however it ends, is will the U.S. continue to remain the leader in Europe? Or because of some of these political, and it's not just the right. I mean, I talked about the Washington Republican right, but your Bernie Sanders, your Elizabeth Warrens, that part of the left also don't believe the United States should be in Europe. They don't believe it for almost the same reasons, is that Europe is rich. Europe has capabilities. We have other obligations. We have China. We have other things. Now, Sanders and Warren will say also we spend too much. And so let Europe spend. Let's just protect. Let's just defend CONUS and that's it. But, you know, what is the role of the United States in terms of in NATO and then being that security protector around the world? I also think that's in question. And so let me stop there. But just by concluding by saying, I think we're at a very historic moment. I applaud all of you for putting on uniforms to be able to defend this nation and other nations. You're going to have a very interesting time. I guess every generation has interesting times. Yours will be no less so. There's a term I used the other day. How good are we learning lessons versus observing lessons? And are we really learning the lessons of what's happened, everything from the political side to the economic to the military here?
Thank you for listening to this episode of Horns of a Dilemma. And please don't forget to visit our website at tnsr.org.